wisdom in the face of modernity, or is faith reasonable? What's the relationship between faith and reason? We could begin by asking, how do we understand the act that a Christian makes when he says or she says, I believe, credo in Latin, right? Because understanding this is actually extremely important for getting clear on the relationship between faith and reason. If you don't understand what we're talking about when we're talking about faith, then all kinds of misunderstandings about the relationship between faith and reason, normally we have a pretty good idea of what we're talking about when we say reason, but it's the faith part that's very important to get clear on, I think, in a contemporary context. So, is faith a leap in the dark? Is it an act of pure obedience? Is it a pure act of entrusting oneself to God no matter what objections the mind might proffer? You find some Christians who would say that faith is primarily a subjective inner conviction, a conviction just like what I've been describing there, a complete placing of trust in myself or my confidence in God or in the Bible, perhaps, something like that. But to this, I think many people in our culture would ask, well, how is that really any different than placing your trust in the Quran? Is it any different? Is it any different than placing your trust in the Book of Mormon? And in fact, if you push this, you might think that you could place your trust in any kind of religious or supposedly revealed tenet at all. And in fact, we do find people who have put their trust, even a very radical trust, in some pretty weird things, some pretty weird revelations. So how many of you remember the name David Koresh? At least a few of you. David Koresh was like a cult leader in Waco, Texas, wasn't it? And he had this apocalyptic vision or this apocalyptic preaching and gathered this whole community around him, and he was stockpiling firearms, and it was, if you read about it on Wikipedia, I'm sure you'll get the main gist of the story, even though it's probably somewhat strange there too, I imagine, on Wikipedia. But what about Marshall Applewhite? Does anybody remember him? Marshall Applewhite was also a cult leader who became convinced that a spacecraft was following the Hale-Bopp comet. Hale-Bopp comet is a comet that passes by Earth once every, I don't know how many years. It was very rare. It was passing near the Earth in 1997. And he was convinced, and he convinced a bunch of other people to follow him in thinking that if you committed suicide with $5.75 in your pocket, you could evacuate the Earth and be translated to the spaceship and avoid being recycled, which was what was going to happen to everyone living on the Earth when the Hale-Bopp comet passed by. And he actually convinced people to do this. So it was a mass suicide. Okay, now that is really crazy. And no one should believe in something like that. Is that what Christians are doing? That is what some people think Christians are doing when they make an act of faith. So actually, it's very helpful for us to be able to clarify and distinguish what really is faith and what is a kind of counterfeit. And I think there are lots of other misconceptions about Christian faith and misinformed debates as a result, false dichotomies that arise about the relationship between faith and reason, or especially in our contemporary discourse about faith and science, which is often where this cashes out. So two different fundamental mistakes, in my view, produce these fundamental dichotomies. And you have this is the second line on the handout here, just so you know where we are. The first is skepticism. And we're all rather familiar with this. It would hold that faith is in itself irrational and contrary to reason. So on this view, faith can't be proved, so therefore it's irrational. In other words, it posits a kind of opposition between faith and reason, because faith cannot be derived from reason or cannot be proved by reason. So a skeptic will say things like, well, contemporary science has disproved religion. And that is a kind of skepticism. Now, this has a kind of flip side, a kind of inverse or a corollary, which, from the perspective of a Thomist like myself, is just as problematic. And we call it fideism. Now, that accepts the critique of the skeptic that faith is fundamentally irrational or irrational, and says, oh, but that's not a problem. Actually, it's okay to have an irrational faith, or even an irrational faith. So sometimes you hear this repeated when people will say things like, well, the Bible is more reliable than anything than contemporary science can demonstrate, so when there's a conflict between what science seems to show and what the Bible seems to say, we just disregard what reason says. And you might associate this actually with certain strands of evangelical Protestantism. And in fact, there are roots here that go quite deep into the Protestant tradition. Reformers like Martin Luther, for example, claimed that reason was completely corrupted by the fall of our first parents from grace, so in original sin. And so consequently, reason cannot be trusted. So one must simply have an unwavering trust by faith. So really, the only thing you can rely on is faith and not reason. Okay, so that's, you see, it's a kind of flip side of the skepticism. Both think that there's a kind of irreconcilable conflict between faith and reason. It's just a question of which you pick. Now, a second corollary of this error that we're talking about here is that faith is purely subjective. Have you encountered this kind of view? Somebody who thinks that, if you are a believer, it's just a purely interior experience of yours. And in fact, I think this is a big problem for speaking about faith in our contemporary culture, certainly on the contemporary university campus where I'm often speaking. And it's important to bring it out into the open. Is belief, a belief by faith, necessarily subjective? Is it, in other words, only true for me because I have this inner conviction? Or can it give us some access to a real and objective truth? Is it public in that way and accessible in a certain sense? Or is it necessarily and always subjective and purely private? Okay, so that's really the first problem. So you have either skepticism or fideism, they're kind of reverse corollaries, and then this second corollary of this initial view, which is that on this view, faith is just subjective. There's a second error about faith and reason, which the Catholic tradition calls rationalism. So in a strong form, it's a kind of inverse of the opposites of skepticism and fideism. So skepticism and fideism posit a dichotomy between faith and reason, whereas rationalism, in contrast, merges them. It merges faith and reason and holds that the faith cannot only be defended from attack by rational argument, but faith itself can be proven by reason, by history, by philosophical argument, and so forth. So notice here that I'm not talking about certain truths that faith professes, which could also be known by reason, like, for example, that God exists. Rationalism goes further than identifying just a certain subset of those truths that can be known both by faith and by reason, and goes further than that. It says, everything that is knowable by faith is also knowable by reason. Now, as surprising as it might be to contemporary skeptics, these very sets of views, the ones that I've just outlined, skepticism, fideism, rationalism, subjectivism, these were hotly disputed in various forms already in the Middle Ages. It's actually interesting, if you begin to study medieval philosophy or medieval theology, you discover that very few of the debates that we have today are actually new debates. A lot of them were debated with much greater sophistication in the Middle Ages, believe it or not. So, for example, in the 13th century, St. Bonaventure, the great Franciscan philosopher and theologian, was quite skeptical about what reason can accomplish apart from faith. And a generation later, in the early 14th century, another famous Franciscan, John Duns Scotus, argued in the other direction, emphasizing the rationality of faith and effectively making faith largely reducible to reason and dramatically curtailing what a Thomist would call its supernatural character. St. Thomas Aquinas, the great Dominican philosopher and theologian of the 13th century, who, of course, is the inspiration for the Thomistic Institute and for most Dominicans. So, you know, I'm not just a partisan of Thomas Aquinas. I actually was convinced by him before I became a follower of his. I do think that he really illuminates this question and many, many others. St. Thomas Aquinas offers a classic approach to these questions about the relationship between faith and reason that centuries later came to typify the main line of the Catholic theology on the relationship of faith and reason. And in fact, what you read in preparation for this evening's talk from the First Vatican Council is largely a close summary of Thomas Aquinas' teaching on the relationship between faith and reason. So some of the things that I've already been mentioning, you should have seen references to rationalism, fideism, skepticism, and so forth. Also the supernatural character of faith, which we'll be talking about a little more. Okay, so with this kind of overview of where the problems are, I'd like to take a step back and get a kind of broad overview of the landscape. Wisdom in the face of modernity. Why that topic? And here you might turn to the back page, the third page of your handout, and you have a little diagram here. And you see divine revelation is at the top, and natural human reason is at the bottom, and there are these two kind of arrows bracketing what is in between. And in a certain way, what this diagram is trying to present is that these are two different paths to coming to know true wisdom. So from the bottom up, we have diverse inquiries of the human intellect based on the natural world, based on our experience of the world around us, that guide us towards what is not only knowledge of the things around us, but what they mean and where they're headed. So metaphysics, you see, just working your way up from the bottom, metaphysics gives you some knowledge about reality, about being, ethics or morals, about what is the purpose of human life, and in fact how to attain what is good for human beings. And science, the inquiry into the cosmos, the reality around us, our place in this larger reality. Then looking at the top, you have also another way towards wisdom. And this is the way of divine revelation. Here you have God speaking to human beings and unveiling or revealing the truth that perhaps some of these truths we could come to know from our own investigation of the world around us, but certainly some of them we would never have been able to know unless God told us about them. And there's some things there in the middle that we'll get to in just a minute. So perhaps the presupposition of this handout is that we would like to seek wisdom. It's actually a good question, I think, to ask. You could ask it for yourself in your own, thinking about your own education. Do modern forms of education, does the contemporary university, did your university lead you to some grasp of wisdom? Did it make you wise? Was it aiming to make you wise? Does anyone graduating from college think that he or she has attained wisdom other than by maybe learning from his or her own mistakes or from maybe a mentor who is especially prudent? But what you learn in the classroom, it tends to be not the focus of the contemporary university, which gives you much specialized knowledge, often of very high value, but not necessarily an explanation of how it all fits together or what it all means. At least when I speak with contemporary university students, I think they often feel this way. Like, they had a bunch of interesting courses, they learned a lot of interesting things, but no one at the end like sat them down and explained how to put it all together. There was no attempt to do that in most contemporary secular universities anyhow. Even philosophy today, in its contemporary idioms, some people might regard, depending on the type of philosophy you're doing, of course, that it doesn't seem to be aiming directly at wisdom. So what is wisdom? Well, you read about this, at least Aquinas' view of this, in the other reading from Aquinas, from the Summa Contra Gentiles. He begins with this question, the search for wisdom, and the value of wisdom. In fact, the absolutely overarching value of wisdom. Why? Because wisdom is not giving you just facts about the world. It is helping you understand the meaning of things. You might even think of the pagan philosophical tradition from ancient Greece. You have, for example, the Delphic Oracle. Does anybody know what was carved over the temple at Delphi? Know thyself, right? Know thyself. That's actually a good starting point if you're going to try to acquire some wisdom. Socrates says at his trial, according to Plato's Apology, the greatest good of man is daily to converse about virtue. And he goes on, the life which is unexamined is not worth living. Suggesting that, in fact, most people in the city don't examine their life. They don't converse about virtue. They don't actually know why they are doing what they are doing. And this kind of life is not as worth living, according to Socrates. He thinks that if you cannot pursue wisdom, then what in the world are you doing? I think that's his attitude. So, as you see in this diagram, there are actually, from the Catholic perspective, different approaches to wisdom. A wisdom, you might say, that arises from below as human reason studies the world around us and actually can make some real progress. But actually a higher wisdom that comes from above that unveils to us who we really are and what we're really meant to live for. So from this point, I'm going to make three main points in the remaining time that we have together. So the first point is clarifying what we're talking about when we discuss belief. Is it just a radical entrusting yourself in the dark, as it were, irrational or irrational? Even on the natural level. And then secondly, why the act of Christian faith, which transcends the natural level, natural belief, is also eminently reasonable. It's reasonable to make this kind of act of belief, not irrational or irrational. And third, why it is both reasonable and supernatural. Okay, so part one, or point one, of these three remaining points. Believing as a human or natural act. So, for St. Thomas Aquinas, believing is fundamentally an act whereby we know something. But we know it not by seeing it, but rather by accepting it on the word of another. That's simply all he's talking about at the kind of most basic natural level when he's talking about believing. So this means that faith is primarily in the intellect. So if you're a Thomist and you're trying to figure out, well, what does faith have to do with? Faith is principally about the mind. Now, that's not the way most people think about it. So already we're making, I think, some progress towards understanding a Catholic view of belief. St. Augustine's classical definition of believing is thinking with assent. Okay, I'm going to explain what that means in just a second. And I think actually the best way to do that is to use an example to understand how faith is in the intellect and how it involves an act of assent, that is, trusting the word of another, which is different from seeing it yourself. Okay, so suppose that you have a brother who is a journalist and he's covering Iraq, Iran, Syria, the Middle East, right? And he's taken prisoner by ISIS. Now, there have been some cases like this where journalists have been taken hostage and held with some other journalists incommunicado for a long time. In fact, there was a media article a few years ago about somebody who was released and came to the family of one of the guys that he was in being held hostage with and delivered a message, basically, on behalf of the journalist who was still being held hostage. Okay, so suppose that happens to you. Suppose it's your brother. He's being held hostage, you think, in Syria somewhere. You haven't heard from him for a couple years. And then one day somebody knocks on your door and says, hey, I just got released from being held in the same like house with your brother, and he sent me a message to you to say, like, don't worry, he's doing okay. He thinks it's all going to work out or something like that. Okay, are you interested in this message? Yes, of course, you're extremely interested in this message. So suppose that what this messenger tells you is kind of fits the picture of your brother. So it's kind of, you know, fits what you would expect him to say. There's a kind of internal coherence to his story. Okay, but you have no way of checking on whether this is what your brother actually said to this guy. Right? You can't even really directly verify that your brother's still alive. And what is most important to you, like, is your brother alive, is precisely what you can't ascertain yourself. So, what would you do? You could check on the credibility of the witness. You could figure out if he really was a journalist, if he really was held incommunicado in Syria, if he's seems like a believable guy. Okay, so after you've done all of that, will you then have direct knowledge? No, you still will not have direct knowledge. All you will have is a credible messenger. So at this point, you have to decide whether you believe him or not. Do you believe his story? And in fact, you cannot replace the word believe there with any other word. Like, do you just think that his story is true? Do you suppose it is true? Are those the same as saying, I believe that it is true? Well, okay, so give this, think this through. He's sitting at your dinner table. He's finished his story. And you say, well, you have really impressed me with your story. And you seem like a very credible person. And so I'm inclined to think that what you've told me is accurate. What would he say? He would say, well, of course it's accurate. I'm telling you, your brother's alive. And you would say, well, yes, but you see, that's what you think, but I have no way of verifying that myself. And he would say, well, what you're saying is that you don't believe me when I tell it to you. And in fact, he'd be right if that's your attitude towards him. So the point of this example is just to show that it's one thing to say, this guy seems very credible, and I think he's probably telling me the truth. And it's another thing to say, my brother is alive. And to really believe that. Because that belief calls for a kind of unconditional assent to the truth of the message that the witness is telling you. So what comes to light from this example, I think, is that believing is not just thinking or supposing. It's actually thinking and then assenting to the truth that is being proposed to you. You have then, when you believe, something really in your mind. You have knowledge in your intellect of a certain kind. Now notice that this has nothing to do with your feelings or your emotions or some kind of subjective experience that you can't put into words. You assent to the truth without condition when your will moves your intellect to say, I believe this. Okay, now we could talk about motives for credibility, like whether you really have a good reason to think that this message is credible. That's a kind of separate question. My point is just to kind of clarify what believing refers to. And here, we're only talking on the natural level, right? This is not a supernatural message he's bringing you. It's just a natural one. So the next thing that you can see from this example is that believing involves believing someone. In other words, it's not just a message, but it also implies a relation to the witness. And it means relying on the witness. So, it makes perfect sense for us to rely on human beings in this way. And in fact, we believe all kinds of things all the time. It would be very hard to go through life without believing things. So you believe, for example, that, Istanbul is a city in Turkey. I mean, I've never been to Istanbul. I have no doubt. I have no doubt whatsoever. I would not say, well, it's 99.9% certain that Istanbul is a city in Turkey. I would say, Istanbul is a city in Turkey. I've not been there, but I believe that without reservation, absolutely without qualification, I believe that. And that's entirely reasonable to do. It would be quite unreasonable, in fact, to always hedge what you think by this kind of distance between saying, well, it's probable, but it's not entirely certain. And in fact, the scientific method itself is largely built on this kind of thing. Why? Because you have to trust that other people are running the experiments that you don't have time to run. No scientist runs every experiment that his whole field is based on. So at a certain point, you have to say, well, I'm trusting the scientific community as a whole to do the experiments in a consistent way so that I can build my research on this knowledge that has been acquired. All right, so these things that I've been talking about are perhaps very difficult for us to know, like it's difficult for you to go to every city and verify that it's really there. But in principle, I suppose, you could. But what if there are some things that are in principle, not just in fact, but in principle, not knowable to us? And there are some things even on the natural level. For example, whether you're liking this talk or not. That is, in principle, not knowable to me, except insofar as you tell me what you think, or as I see you like smile and nod or frown or whatever. And you might be trying to deceive me, right? You might just be a very good actor because you have some other reason to make me think that you liked it, when in fact you're thinking that guy's pretty much a loser. And priests constantly have this problem when you're walking out of Mass, by the way. You know, everybody's saying, oh, nice homily, Father. And it's like, yeah, I don't think that was, I don't think they really thought that. But This is necessary. I mean, for example, does your mother really love you? I mean, in all seriousness, does your mother really love you? How do you know? I mean, hopefully few people here doubt that. But it is not in principle directly perceptible to you. Or whether your spouse loves you. I mean, there, of course, many human beings have much more experience with having maybe some question arise in their mind at a certain point. Like, does this guy really love me or not? I don't know. Okay, this brings us to supernatural faith. So now we're talking about, this is really the second point. So we're moving from believing on a natural level, which I'm trying to say is a reasonable thing to do, and that we do all the time, and we do it about very important things, and things that we stake our lives on these things regularly. Okay, so it's not irrational, and it's not just a feeling. It's actually to have a credible witness and to assent to what the person believes without reservation. Okay, so supernatural faith. For Aquinas, the act of a Christian who says, I believe, credo, is analogous to these kinds of natural acts of believing we've been talking about, but with an important difference. Because it is properly supernatural, that is, it's an act that transcends or exceeds what a human nature is capable of doing on its own, which is why faith, properly so called, is a theological virtue. Okay, so I'd like to clarify the relationship between this theological virtue of faith and reason. And here we find Aquinas' answer to that first error about faith that I was talking about at the beginning, that faith and reason are opposed. So that produces either skepticism or fideism. So Aquinas, and he articulates this in the Summa Contra Gentiles in a short treatment. I think you probably noticed that towards the end of your excerpt from Aquinas. He has a much longer treatment in a work called the De Trinitate, his commentary on the De Trinitate of Boethius, if you want to look it up. It's his best treatment of this theme. And there he articulates the relationship between faith and reason and between the disciplines of theology and philosophy, which at the time was a very hot topic at the University of Paris, where he was, because there was this new wave of Aristotelian philosophy that was coming into the university, and the theologians were questioning whether this pagan philosophy could actually be reconciled with Christian faith, and you had various positions being staked out by different people in the university. Aquinas has a serene confidence in reason, rightly employed, that it will never be able to demonstrate that a claim made by faith is false. So he actually thinks that you can really just trust reason to do its work if it's working well. So if reason seems to disprove something about the faith, and you found this in the First Vatican Council towards the end, if reason seems to disprove something that is held by faith, then either you are not reasoning correctly, and you'll be able to go back and figure out that either the proof didn't work, or it's not demanding your assent, it's just probable, it's a probable judgment, but not a proof, or that you are misunderstanding what the teaching of faith is. Because both of these things come from God, who is the source of both the light of faith and the light of reason, God who is truth itself, and so God cannot be the source of a contradiction, since God is the author of both faith and reason. Therefore, we should have great confidence in doing the work of reason. And actually, the reason why Aquinas was articulating this was precisely because there were these new disciplines intruding into the university, and you had some theologians saying, oh, I'm a little nervous about this. And Aquinas was saying, no, you don't need to be nervous. You can follow reason wherever it leads you. It's not going to be able to contradict faith, because faith and reason exist in harmony, even though they are of different orders. Okay, so this is also a capital point. Faith and reason do not simply merge into one. That's the second error that I was talking about. They are different orders that are looking, in a way, at the same reality, but in different ways. So the First Vatican Council also talks about this. You have a kind of natural order, which is intelligible by the light of reason, as we look at the world around us and we see the things that that we can observe, and we can infer, for example, that there must be a cause of them, and there must be an unchanging cause of them. We could go through the various proofs for the existence of God drawn from knowledge of the world around us. Aquinas thinks that that's one way to come to a real knowledge of God. But there is a knowledge of God of another order. That's a knowledge of God of the supernatural order that knows God not just as the cause of the world or the goal of our lives, but knows God as, for example, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. That is a truth that natural reason could never discover in principle, except that God has told us about it. And likewise, that you are invited to communion with God, to eternal life, sharing in the divine nature itself, to be divinized. That's actually what the scriptures say is our destiny. To share in the divine nature, that's a quote from 2 Peter. So this kind of promise is something that vastly exceeds anything we could ever imagine. And that means that the knowledge of God that we get by faith, because God speaks to us, this is of a different order. It's of a higher wisdom. That is, it gives us a sense of the meaning of the cosmos in a different way than other kinds of knowledge that we gain from the world. It's a kind of knowledge coming down from above, a stronger light. At the same time, however, Aquinas thinks that the truths of faith are believable. They are credible. So even though they are supernatural, even though in a way they are coming to us from above, nonetheless, they are believable, and it's quite reasonable to believe them. So what are the reasons that Aquinas would offer for this? He gives several overlapping ones. To begin with, faith depends on certain truths that reason can prove, such as, for example, that God exists, that God is one, and so forth. These are called the preambles of faith, or the preambula fidei. That is, the things that reason can do that prepare the way, that walk before faith. Literally, that's what that means. The preambula fidei, they walk before faith. Faith presupposes them and needs them to be proved by reason, Aquinas thinks. Why? Because if God speaks to you, you have to be able to think that God exists. So it's a problem if the person speaking to you is a figment of your imagination. But Aquinas goes on. It's very hard for us even to know natural things adequately by our own power. Why should we assume, then, that we can know things of God adequately by our own power? In fact, that's not a reasonable assumption at all. I mean, we have a very hard time just figuring out, like, what is animal instinct? What is gravity? I mean, if you can look in physics and discover all kinds of puzzling questions. How to understand light as a particle or a wave? I mean, we could make a very long list that contemporary science has lots and lots of questions. And it's not clear that we have made a whole lot of advance in, like, getting to the bottom. We've made progress, to be sure, but there are still many questions that remain. I was talking with a guy who works in neuroscience who was saying that, what we know about neuroscience now, this is a professor of neuroscience at Stanford. He was saying what we know about neuroscience now is like 0.01% of 1% of what we think we could eventually know about the brain. I mean, our knowledge of brain science is just very, very small compared to the mystery of that. Okay, why should we then think that knowing the mystery of God is going to be something that we can wrap our minds around from our own power in an accurate or reasonable way? So, in other words, Aquinas thinks that it's quite reasonable to believe what Christianity proposes to us, and that we need to do that, and that it's confirmed by certain supernatural signs. The First Vatican Council speaks about this too. These are called the credibilia, the motives of credibility. So things like miracles are a kind of divine attestation that Jesus is speaking the truth about his Father. And then there's a kind of beautiful internal coherence to the Catholic faith that is also a kind of witness to its truth in a way that other religious systems do not necessarily display. And you have then things like the Church's continuous existence. The First Vatican Council talks about that, its stability in its teaching and so forth, as a motive for believing the witness. Okay, but do you see what the point of this is? It's that someone actually has come from God and told us something that is both reasonable and credible. So it's reasonable in the sense that it makes sense, it fits together, and it's also credible because it's confirmed by certain signs of credibility. And the response then, the Christian's response, is to say without qualification, I believe the witness. I believe what the witness is telling me. And in fact, when we're talking about the Christian faith, we're talking about a publicly proclaimed set of truths, a message of Jesus Christ in the gospel, for example. That isn't some kind of esoteric or hidden or subjective thing. It's something that everyone can hear and in a way can be shared in by many of us. I mean, in fact, I think the Catholic understanding is that our faith really does unite us in a kind of true communion of faith, so that we are all actually united in Christ as we believe the same thing. And notice what the character of this belief then has. It requires a full or unconditional assent to all of the truth that is being proposed by the witness. So you can't say, well, I believe like 99 of the things that the witness says, but this 100th thing here, I don't accept. That would not be reasonable if you've judged that the witness is credible and if you cannot verify these things on your own. In other words, if you do something like that, if you reserve judgment on part of the witness's message, what you are effectively saying is, I am the ultimate standard of judgment about whether this is true or false. I am not just entrusting myself to the testimony of the witness and believing it without qualification. But that is precisely what, even on the natural level, the act of belief calls for. And on the supernatural level, that's also what supernatural faith involves. So that's also part of the big problem, theologically speaking, with so-called cafeteria Catholicism. Because Aquinas actually has the treatment of this in the 13th century. He says, people who do this are not believing by the supernatural motive of God's grace impelling them to assent to whatever the witness proposes to them. They are believing according to their own light, according to their own judgment, which means they do not have supernatural or divine faith. In other words, that is a faith that is not saving. Okay, now that's a very controversial and difficult thing to say today, because there are a lot of people who are in that position. So we might need to add some further qualifications about their culpability or whether they're in a state of ignorance. And so I would add all of those things if we have time to talk about them later. But you see the point, which is that it's really important to give a kind of unconditional assent to the witness. Okay, the last thing that I want to say, and this is the final point, we're sort of running out of time here, so I will just make it very quickly, that faith for Aquinas is properly supernatural. And this is a very important point to underline, because it provides the response to the second major error about faith, which is rationalism. That is the view that reason can prove all of the truths of faith, or that faith in some way can be reduced back into reason, that they're so coherent that they kind of collapse into one another. And for Aquinas, he thinks that this fundamentally misunderstands what faith is. Because he thinks, and there's six reasons. I'm just going to run through them very quickly, and then we'll conclude. The first reason is that faith prepares you to actually be drawn into the life of God himself. You begin to know God as God knows himself. So God, who understands himself perfectly, begins to tell you about himself, about his inner life, as it were. He invites you into that kind of communion in his inner life. And so you begin to know him somehow like the way he knows himself. Now, far less than he knows himself, of course, but nonetheless, really, as it were, from the inside. It's like the difference between, I don't know, knowing Brad Pitt from a distance. I don't know how many people here are fans of Brad Pitt. You know, if you're too much of a fan, if you're like hanging outside of his house, the police will eventually arrest you. If you're following him around, you know, you can know a lot of things about Brad Pitt and never be invited inside of his life, right? And there are some people who are a little weird about things like this. Okay? They may know more about Brad Pitt, like where he went to grade school or something, than his wife or his girlfriend or whatever. Is he married currently? He has been married, hasn't he? But yeah, okay, so I'm not up on Brad Pitt, but anyway, if Brad Pitt has to like invite you in to sort of share his interior life, that's what we do in human relationships of friendship, deep friendship, or love. We open our hearts to another person. Aquinas is saying, that's what God is doing with you when he speaks to you by faith. So he is opening himself, his interior life, to you and giving you a share in it. So that produces a kind of communion which is supernatural, because you can never get that from the outside. No matter how hard you try, you cannot generate it yourself. He has to take the initiative with you. And that's precisely the way Aquinas understands the act of faith to work. So this is the second point. A human being cannot divinize himself or herself. God has to do this. So faith cannot be generated by human action. God has to move you. In fact, he has to elevate you. He has to give you a higher light so that you can judge that this is true, what he's saying to you. Now, you aren't able to see why it is true. That's the hard part for us. So you see that it is true by this movement of faith, this interior grace that moves you to assent. That's the supernatural impulse of faith. But you don't see the reason why it's true. It's like believing the witness, right? You are as if God could kind of give you a supernatural impulse to somehow grasp the truth that the witness is telling you without letting you see the evidence for it. You just know that what's being borne witness to you is in fact true. Okay, that's what's happening with faith. And so this has a corollary, by the way, that our minds are made to know the truth by experiencing it like in the world around us through our senses. So our minds naturally want to investigate the reasons. When you know something by faith alone, so this is a truth like the God is triune that cannot be accessed by natural reason, your mind is never going to be fully satisfied. That's part of the difficulty. It continues to churn because you're trying to gain some traction on this mystery, but in principle, it's not accessible to us. Okay, the third thing is that, I've already sort of said this, in faith the believer receives not only data about God, but a kind of supernatural light that strengthens your understanding. Fourth, that it brings you into the interior knowledge of God. Okay, these are just various ways of kind of spelling out the things that I've already said. You have to be moved by God to it. That's the fifth point. And the final point that it bears fruit in charity. So that's, let me just conclude with this point, that faith is profoundly fruitful. It puts us into a relationship with God, a relationship of trust and dependence. Okay, so there is real trust there, but it's not an irrational trust or an unreasonable trust. It's a reasonable trust that, like a human relationship, like a human offer of love, erupts into love, or it normally it should. So this is the perfection of faith, really, is that it erupts into love. As you know God, you love him. And you see, in a certain sense, very obscurely, how good he is. And the more you know him, the more you love him, and the more you love him, the more you're drawn into knowing him. And it's a virtuous circle in that way. Now, it's possible to know God by faith and not love him. And that's what we call dead faith. We can talk about that in the Q&A if you like. Somebody who loves created things, who knows God, but loves created things more than God, loves my own special sin more than God, that person has dead faith. It's a faith not animated by charity. And that's a bad position to be in. So I hope you're not in that position. If you are, go to confession and get back in the state of grace. This is actually the great joy that comes from faith, that you begin to discover that there is another realm, a realm higher than what reason can know, and that as you enter into it, your life opens up. It's like a flower opening, and it becomes incredibly beautiful and incredibly fruitful. It's something that you cannot simply know from the outside, but once you have tasted the delight of and the joy that comes from God, then, well, it makes all the difference in the world. And that's precisely why it is wisdom in the face of modernity for us. So, thank you.
When we say the creed, how necessary is the first article to be prefaced by the verb "I believe"? Because it seems like I believe in one God, like that.
Yeah.
The first article could very well just be demonstrated by the preamble of faith. So, is it necessary that we always say it in that formulation, or is there a reason behind the church having that formulation?
Well, I mean, I guess what you're asking is not whether it's I or we, but just the fact that you begin with the truth that God, that one God exists.
Or that I believe it.
Yeah.
I just want to know it.
Yeah, that's right. Well, so you're also professing a lot of other things there too. And so Aquinas' answer to this, he doesn't take up this precise question, but he thinks that you can know that God exists and that God is one from reason. He thinks it's hard to do, and it takes a lot of philosophical work, and a lot of people have tried and gotten it wrong, but in principle it's possible to do. But in fact, that many of us know it by faith, not having worked through the philosophical proofs. So it's perfectly legitimate to believe it, even though you haven't worked through the proofs, but it is, like, philosophically speaking, important, if we're going to say that faith is reasonable, that you be able to demonstrate those things. That someone at least be able to demonstrate those things. Does that answer your question?
Any other questions? Thank you, Father. Can you tell us where to find proofs of belief in the Summa?
Well, so you would have the proofs of the existence of God are in question two.
Proofs of belief.
Like the preambles of faith or something like that.
Yeah.
You know, the better place to go is probably in the... You can find in the Summa offhand, where does he talk about this? I don't remember which question it was offhand, but I can tell you in the Summa Contra Gentiles, he certainly talks about this.
Does he address the separate question of motives? So
I'm interested in the separate.
Yes, well, even that. Yeah, he addresses that in the very text you read. So, chapter 6 on page 13.
Okay. Because I'm wondering in how far this translates into the natural realm when we believe someone who's witnessing to any truth, whether or not it's like a tentative faith, but it's someone who comes to you and says they've seen something. And so,
right.
And it's your responsibility to report it. But
how yeah.
do you believe the witness? I mean, and so some of the statements you've said don't, outside of the, you know, the faith context, in a secular context, it sounds like would still ring completely true. That
yes.
You have to take their credibility, make a determination, and then believe them. And it's our Christian duty to believe people who are telling the truth based on evidence. We have to believe. And so anyway, I'm just very interested in learning more
yeah.
about what point do we, when can we judge credibility? When are we allowed to be the judge? And when are we not allowed to be the judge in a 100% natural context?
Yeah, so that's, I mean, obviously the whole controversy over Brett Kavanaugh, you know, I wrote this talk before that happened. And as I was, you know, looking through it, I was like, wow, you know, this has a whole new resonance now about, like, believing the credibility of the witness. Like, you, okay, so that, obviously that happens in law courts all the time, where you have something that is a historical event. So in this, you know, in that case, you're talking about a historical, a supposedly historical moment, and there's not a lot of, we don't have a lot of access to that. It's actually one of my pet peeves that I've heard people, even going back to the Clarence Thomas hearings. I was an intern here in Washington, D.C. when the Clarence Thomas hearings happened. I went to them before the Anita Hill allegations came out. And then afterwards, you know, so I followed that, you know, discussion of that ever since it happened back in the 90s. And it always drives me crazy when people say, well, we can't know what happened. It's like, well, okay, hold on. It's, in principle, it is knowable. Like, it's knowable for a person what happened. Now, it's just not accessible to us. It's like the POW or the person being held hostage incommunicado. Like, it's not impossible for a human being to know that. It's just not practically speaking, in fact, we can't know it except based on the testimony of these people. And we just have two people who are telling different, giving different accounts of it. And then, okay, we have to make a judgment. At the end, we have to make a judgment. And how do you make that judgment? Well, it's not easy to do. You have to assess the credibility of the witnesses. And normally the law also has a presumption. So you start with a baseline. So obviously in a criminal case, you have the presumption of innocence. In a civil case, so this comes up in civil cases too, not only criminal cases. In a civil case where, as the other lawyers here would know, you have a preponderance of evidence standard. That means, like, you have to have just more than a 50%, you know, of the likelihood, whereas beyond reasonable doubt in a criminal case is a much higher standard of proof. But in any case, in a civil matter, you just, one side has the burden of proof, and where you have two witnesses who are the only two, you know, people giving evidence on this point, and it's the central point, and they disagree. Well, you're just going to have to make a judgment who you believe. That's what juries do all the time. I mean, the criminal justice system is based on that. Now, it's much better when you have other evidence that can corroborate elements of the story. And that's exactly what we saw with the Kavanaugh hearing. You know, attempts to look at evidence other than just what this person says and what this person says to see if there are surrounding things that suggest credibility, you know, that this story is more likely true than this story. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think it's terribly mysterious, you know,
is
but
it
it's...
Like a, is it a crisis in faith?
Well, okay, so what you might simply say in that case is, I don't know who to believe, so I don't believe anything about that. I have an opinion about it. So actually, Aristotle and Aquinas following him said that there are four classic modes of knowing, or, knowing is not the right way to put it, four ways that your mind can be related to a proposition. That sounds very technical, but you're going to get it immediately, okay?
You can.
Well, no, this is a philosophical distinction, okay? So just use a ridiculous thing like someone comes in and says, Elvis is alive, okay? You know? Okay, so that proposition, Elvis is alive. You can, how can your mind relate to that? You can say, I doubt that that is true. Okay, so that is doubt. You do not know that it is true because you have not observed it yourself, but you think it's rather unlikely, and you like incline rather strongly to not agree with the claim that the statement is true. Okay, so that's doubt. You can have an opinion. Now, opinion classically is like the opposite side of doubt. I mean, it's like the positive side where you say, oh, actually, I think it probably is true, but I don't have any knowledge of it myself, but it seems likely to me. Okay, so doubt and opinion, you know, we often find ourselves in that circumstance. You can believe that it is true. That is because, you know, Julie is the one who came in and told us that, and we just totally believe her as the witness, as we generally would if it weren't for saying Elvis is alive, which is a rather incredible thing to say. But okay, so you can believe, that's the natural belief, like we discussed. And then you can know, that's the fourth way. Knowledge means you have direct access to it. That would be like you walk out the door and you shake Elvis's hand. So in many cases, we have neither knowledge nor belief, but opinion or doubt. And, you know, so that's perfectly fine. I mean, in law courts, you do that kind of thing all the time. You're like, well, I don't know who to believe. My opinion is that this person is more credible, so I guess I'm going to vote for that, you know. In fact, in the whole Brett Kavanaugh thing, you have seen the sort of range of people, certainly some senators who are like, I don't know what to think. You know, I'm kind of inclining this way, I'm kind of inclining that way. Well, at the end of the day, I guess I tend to have this opinion because it seems more probable to me. And then you have some who are just like, I believe what he said, or I believe what she said, and without any qualification. Like, I have no qualification in my affirming the truth of this statement at all.
Great.
Do we
have time for one more question?
This is a little different. The question has to do with the interface really between how the mind is working and how whatever faculty it is in us that inclines towards love of God. And maybe how does the interface between the intellect and whatever it is that loves, how do they dovetail? How do they work together such that prayer and knowledge encompass the whole person towards that getting into the inner life of God? Because there are some people who really appeal to the head. I think probably a lot of people in this room, and then there are probably a lot of people who are very simple. So how does that work?
Yeah, so, I mean, Aquinas has a very beautiful and rather sophisticated account of how these two powers in us, so the powers of a rational creature are, or any rational being, because God has these powers too, he's not a creature. Any rational being has two powers, a power of intellect or knowing, and a power of willing or loving. So actually this is, you know, maybe not quite what you were asking, but it's important to know that for Aquinas, the will is not principally a faculty of choosing, like choosing between contraries. That's a modern way of thinking about it. But for Aquinas, it's the power of loving. It's the rational desire. So think about the way you desire something. I mean, you're a physician, are you not? So when you have a patient who has a very serious disease, say a terminal disease, you meet these people, and they really want the experimental treatment, you know, even the chemo, you know. They don't like the chemo, but they want it like with an intellectual appetite. if they think that it might save their life. And that's a rational desire. It's not a desire for physical pleasure. It's not an appetite like hunger, which is sort of directly related to sense life. It's a desire of the mind, which is very powerful. The more you become convinced that this medicine could actually save my life. And so that's part of what's happening there. So it's not just appealing to some technical knowledge. Like as you grasp the reality with your intellect, your will responds to it by desiring what you perceive as good. And it has this mutually interacting kind of back and forth relationship. And this is happening to us constantly all the time, where what we perceive with our minds to be good, we reach out for. And that means we're loving it. And of course that's exactly what Aquinas thinks is going on with the will. The will is loving. It's loving what your mind grasps as good. Does that answer your question? Maybe not really.
It's helpful, but it's interesting to me why would somebody be more drawn to want to know technical aspects about God and derive fellowship through that process, whereas others don't need that?
Yeah, I guess what I'm saying is I think both of the people you're describing are both knowing God and loving Him. So maybe that's what I should say. I don't really accept the distinction between them because I think everybody does both. And you can certainly say, oh, there are some people who sort of have their way more through the affections or through love. Aquinas would say, absolutely, you know, we meet people like that, but they don't love what they don't know. Like if they don't know it, they just don't. So they have to know it in some measure before they can begin loving it. And there may just be aspects of the goodness of the thing that speak more to this person and other aspects that speak more to that person. I mean, we meet people all the time who like, you know, just love geometry. And other people are like, you know, get me out of here. I cannot, like, I'm not interested in this. I want to go watch the baseball game or whatever. It's not that, so there are aspects of the truth that's there that appeal to them in different ways, but both of them are knowing in some way and loving in some way. I don't know, maybe I'm not really answering your question again, but maybe we can talk about this, you know, okay. And continue the conversation. Yeah.
Please join me in thanking Father Donovan.